The purpose of this is pacifying the mind. Much of the confusion that comes into our lives has to do with speed and complexity. So retreats are geared to slow you down. A retreat hinges on a few things. One of them is that we play by certain rules. So we try to not address each other. We try not to seek each other's attention. We all have good reasons to have come here, reasons that only we can know. And we all have some work to do on our own hearts, on our own minds. We have a history, we have habits, we have talents, we have virtues, and we have hang-ups. And learning to make the heart grow and wake up is not easy work. Yeah. There are many things that hinder the mind. Distraction is one, preoccupation is one, desire is one, unattentiveness is one, laziness is one, anger is one, aversion is one. There's many things that make growing up not easy. So retreats are intended to make us more aware of these habits. When we feel the pain of bad habits, we are more motivated to give them up. When we feel the goodness of wholesome habits, we are motivated to strengthen them. So the first task of such a retreat is to acknowledge some of the rules. Not pulling other people out of their work. A work only each of us individually can do. So by seeking attention from other people, I incur two disadvantages. One of them, I deflect from attending to myself. B, I stop somebody else from attending to themselves. So the most powerful way to leave people without me calling their attention onto me is by not talking to them. So I'd like to make clear that I expect you not to talk to each other. Yeah? Even if you like each other, even if you share rooms with each other, even if you're used to talk to people, please do not talk. Make a promise to yourself right now that you will not engage in conversation for the duration of this retreat. I was very mild and let you speak tonight at dinner, and I was really impressed how quiet it was despite my explicit allowance. So that was a good omen. I think you have talent in this domain. So make a commitment. Switch off your mobile phones, your cells. Yeah? Los celulari, okay, for the duration of your retreat. Switch them off. If you think you need them to wake up, you don't. There are bells, you can switch them off. Really do switch them off. Yeah. I mean it. Put them on flight mode.
Actually, we collected them. We have collected
them. All of them.
All of them. So if anyone hasn't...
Beautiful. Wonderful.
If anyone hasn't, they are invited to do so.
Okay, where can they...
Managers,
yeah? Just in case, if there's a stray cell phone still somewhere in one of your pockets, you know, sometimes one of them sneaks in, yeah? Just help this poor stray phone to meet its friends. All its friends are with the managers. Wonderful. Thank you. It's an excellent habit. I will remember that one to recommend in other places. Good. The next big rule is basically be here. This whole thing only works to the extent you apply yourself to it. There's an old Indian term called yoga, which means yoke, which is the piece of wood you put over oxen so that they are restrained in their lateral movement. What is a yoke? Ol? Ein Vavlamit? Ol, huh? Good. Just one Vavlamit. So you know what an oil is, yeah, and what it does. It restrains movement to one side, and it helps movement to be more long-lasting towards the other side. Yeah? So, this is what the Buddha used a lot, this word. It didn't mean Hatha Yoga in those days. Hatha Yoga is 1,000 years later. No, actually, 1,500 years later. When the Buddha meant Anuyojeti, he meant apply yourself, yeah? Put effort into things. Practice. We would say train today. So this is what I mean when I say this whole retreat format only works if you're actually here. If you're willing to be here. That sounds easy, yeah? Just be here. But actually it means you have so many choices, you know. I've been doing this for a while, this retreat business. So I know many of you have parallel programs. Yeah. There's a program, it's on here, yeah? And then there's the program Akinjana has in his head, but I have my own little program, yeah? So that's the time when I take a nap, and that's the time when I go for a walk, and that's the time when I take a shower when everybody else meditates, and, yeah? So I have my little parallel program. Yeah? So what I mean is basically give up parallel programs. Just settle for one program. My suggestion would be, let's make it this program. Yeah. Sorry, this is not very original, but you know what I mean. Sometimes these parallel programs are not quite acknowledged in the mind. Yeah. You know, the mind has many, many compartments. Some compartments, they tell very clear what I want and what I do and what's happening. Other compartments, they don't quite tell. Yeah. It's more like the labels are not very clear. There is no numbers there. It doesn't say what's actually happening. But somehow it's happening anyway. We have learned about this through psychology. There are parts of our mind which want things that when we ask whether these things are wanted, these parts answer back and say, no, we don't want anything. Yeah. So try to acknowledge both your aspiration to be here, to participate, and to give yourself to these exercises. And when you deviate from this, try to acknowledge this as early as possible. You don't need to produce a full-blown resistance pattern here. Yeah? Go into long denials and suddenly find yourself halfway down to a fula, only to find out that your walking path has somehow extended. So try to acknowledge to yourself when the parallel program kicks in. If you've never had a parallel program, maybe come to talk to me afterwards. You know? We need to do some serious talking. I would also like to invite you to make your mind very large what concerns meditation. Yeah, so some of us think that meditation is what's happening when we're on our cushion with eyes closed, straight back, looking like little angels. Yeah, so yeah, that sometimes is called meditation. But I would like you to think of meditation in bigger ways. The Buddha has another word for meditation. It's a strange term, meditation. Comes from Latin meditare, means thinking, which is mostly what meditation is precisely not. Yeah? So for some reason, the word thinking has been used to translate a Buddhist word called bhavana. Bhavana, cultivation, making, bringing things into being. Yeah? This term is what the Buddha uses when he speaks of meditation. And this has many facets. One facet is making the mind still. One facet is learning how to relate to the body. One facet is learning how to relate to others. Kaya bhavana, sila bhavana, chitta bhavana. Making the mind resonate with empathy. That's the development of the Brahma viharas, which will concern us later on. And finally, we have the cultivation or the bringing into being of insight. That's Panya Bhavana. These are very, very big domains of practice. Now, for some reason, I have never quite understood. This has been translated with meditation. So, meditation is a lot more than just sitting still and looking like a quiet angel. Meditation is also what's happening outside of this room. So I'd like you to make that notion of meditation so big that the sneezing of your neighbor is part of your meditation, that walking carefully over people's shoes out there when it's wet and slightly crowded, that is part of your meditation. Making as little noise for your neighbors as possible when you have to leave a sitting or when you come a little late, that also is part of your meditation. All of this is part of your meditation. In fact, everything that happens from now on until the end of this retreat, I wish you'd understand as being part of your meditation. Yeah? Retreats are collective experiences. Yeah? We're building an atmosphere. We're doing something that is slightly unusual. There's many of us together and we're not talking. For some of us, this is comforting. This is agreeable. This is wonderful. Not having to talk, not having to converse, not having to say who you are, what you do, how much you earn, what you like, what you don't like, where you've been yesterday, where you're going to be tomorrow afternoon, something like that. The day after tomorrow afternoon, in fact. You know, for some of us, this is pleasant. Others find it strange to not talk with so many people. In our societies, it's not usually the case that when we're together with others that we don't talk. Some of us may experience that as threatening. So be a little aware of what's happening around speaking, the impulse of speaking, and what's happening when the impulse of speaking is not gratified, when you just hold it. That's one of the freedoms we truly have. We can acknowledge impulses, we can hold and feel impulses, and we do not have to either enact the impulse nor repress it. What would you call enact? Inszenieren.
Live all.
Okay? So that's what you do in theater. You enact. Oh, sweet. Thank you. We'll talk about this later. So, you're getting the point, yeah? Meditation offers an alternative between the binary strategy of enactment or repression. It means I am creating the safety of an inner psychic space in which I am completely allowed to feel what I feel without having to repress it, but also without enacting it. In other words, without making it overflow into my actions, into my speech, into my mental and intentional movements. Does that make sense? I tell you that. It's very cheaply. Yeah, right at the beginning. It's taken me quite some time for me to figure that one out. Yeah, I don't want to tell you how long, but I remember when it was. Yeah? So, creating an inner space in which I am allowed to feel completely my impulses, my feelings, my experience as whole, as wholly as possible. I am completely allowed to feel whatever I feel. And I am allowed to do that because I know I will not repress this and I will not enact this. I will not make this go out and I will not push it down under. There's a great freedom to that. You can think of this as a sort of alchemy. And it's this allowance and this promise to not enact and to not repress that makes the basis for transformation, that makes the basis for growth, that makes the basis for sublimation. Being together as many as we are only is possible because we abide by some ethic standards. We don't hit each other, not just not in public, but also not in private. We don't hurt each other, we're not cruel, we don't try to harm. That's a commitment, it's important. We're not taking away things from each other. We're not stealing. We're not just taking somebody's cushion or somebody's blanket or even somebody's place, let alone other things. We respect the space other people consider theirs for the time being, and we respect their property. This is important. That makes it safe to be with each other. We're also not exploitative. We're not flirting. We're not trying to matchmake. We're not trying to meet somebody. We're not trying to stimulate people erotically. We're trying to create an environment in which we can be as safe and as much with ourselves as is possible. It's difficult to attend to the needs of one's own mind. And we can help each other in this, and we can also hinder each other in this. So I'd like us to agree on the fact that we want to help each other. We acknowledge nobody can do the work I need to do. Nobody can clear the mind from this being, from afflictions, from ignorance. Nobody can do my work. Nobody can do your work. So if you do not attend to yourself, nobody else will be able to attend to yourself. Nobody can become awake in your place. That means I have to attend here rather than run away to other things, to stimulation, to anger, to flattery, to distraction. So we make commitments to support each other in this. Speaking should be easy this time because we have agreed to noble silence. If the house burns, it's okay to talk, yeah? Just to be clear. Noble silence is not stupid silence or vocal silence or so. There may be occasions when you actually need to say something. Scorpio bites are probably not an issue at that time of the year, but we had scorpio bites here, so it's... when you deem there is danger to life and others, yours and others, then by all means do speak. But we make a commitment, and that makes our fourth precept already clear, to noble silence. Finally, the last of the precepts is about not distracting our minds, not clouding our minds. It means we do avoid unnecessary stimulation here, unnecessary sounds, unnecessary images, no reading, anything that takes you away from our immediate exercise of bringing the attentional focus to the body, to the breath, and to the practice of the Brahma Viharas. So you understand that the atmosphere of this course depends on your willingness to do this, even if it feels funny, artificial, or no fun. So I'd request from you that you honor these principles. Even you may find these are not very agreeable principles, or they're a bit boring, or personally you don't need them, but maybe somebody else is grateful if you try to apply yourself to these principles. Yeah. As far as our topic is concerned, the Brahma Viharas are pretty big in Buddhist teaching. I would expect many of you to have heard quite a bit about them. They're important. How important, I didn't know when I began practicing. You know, for me, the old days, Brahma Viharas were things that were for people who didn't really know how to meditate. Yeah. Brahma Viharas was kind of being nice. It was for people who didn't have any samadhi. That was my understanding. I am glad to say that my practice has progressed to the extent that I have come to change my understanding. Nowadays, I am pretty convinced that I cannot think of a single domain of practice in which the Brahma Viharas do not play a major role. how our societies here in the West lack a deep understanding of these Brahmaviharas. Our health systems lack an understanding of these Brahmaviharas. Our education system lack an understanding of these Brahmaviharas. Our health care systems in our hospital generally lack an understanding of Brahmaviharas. They are huge. In fact, there is no concept in Buddhist teaching of health without the Brahmaviharas, of growth, of sanity, of realization, of wholeness, of maturity. All these concepts entail an understanding of the Brahmaviharas. So many of you will be familiar with the Brahmaviharas as meditation exercises. I'd like to tonight just say that the Brahmaviharas are more than just meditation exercises. First and foremost, the Brahmaviharas are immeasurable qualities of the human heart. They are the qualities that make us human beings. They constitute the humanum of our existence. Now, on that level, the Brahmaviharas are not objects, they are not moods, they are not states, they are not meditation practices, and you can't lose them. Yeah. It's important to understand it. I have a running argument with many psychologists who keep trying to convince me that Brahmaviharas are basically complex emotions. But let me affirm here very clearly, Brahmaviharas are not complex emotions, okay? Complex emotions are states, and states come and go. Your Brahmaviharas as innate and inherent qualities of the human heart do not come and go. They are there. That's what makes you a human being. It's a fundamental capacity to relate in empathetic ways with other beings. Other beings including yourself. And this capacity is there. This empathy has different tones. One of them is more friendly, one of them is more compassionate, one of them is more joyful, one of them is more equanimous. All four forms are relational. The Brahmaviharas are the practices for the human world, for the relational world. They're not little states in your mind which you produce in meditation. They are relational, empathetic skills in your heart. And at the most profound level, long before you know the name, they are there and cannot be lost. That's important to understand. They're hardwired. That's what makes you part of humanity, because you have the implicit possibility to relate to others in empathetic ways. This is at the root of the growth of the neocortex, for example, if you want to know. There's been a guy called Australopithecus, Homo Australopithecus, that's been running around on this planet for 4 billion years, okay? It's a long time. It's a very successful model. Had the brain of a chimpanzee, 400 grams. Not much empathy. Very successful, in evolutionary terms, but no brain development. Very little brain development. Evolutionary psychologists always assumed that upright walking and the growth of human neocortex went together, until they found out that actually there's plenty of people on this planet who are running around walking upright without having any brain development. So this is a very recent invention, this neocortex, yeah, this neocortical growth. This is very important. And you know what made it possible? What made it necessary was adaptation. A lot of change, rapid changes in which we could adapt only very quickly. And under these circumstances, nature decided to cope with these rapid changes, that adaptability was going to be the major feature of this brain. Adaptability, whatever you call it. Buddhists call it bodhicitta. You can wake up. Other people call it neuroplasticity. Psychotherapists and Buddhist teachers likewise like to think that human people basically can learn. They can grow. That's a big message. Things not just change for the worse. Human beings can learn. Not just little rats.
Yeah.
Not just operant conditioning. Yeah. There's other ways of learning. One way of learning was empathy. Everything we have learned in this world that is of any significance, you will have learned with others, through others, from others. Most of our learning happens in relationship with others. Your language you have learned, mindfulness you only learn in such ways, and empathy itself you only learn from others. You need somebody to be that way with you, mindful or talking or empathetic. Then you need somebody to model that for you so that you can see it in others. You have to feel it as at the receiving end. And then you need somebody to help you when you try to do it yourself. All this only becomes possible through empathy. Now, Brahmaviharas, this is what empathy is called in Buddhist speak. Brahmaviharas means I am capable of relating to people, to myself and others and things in forms that resonate friendly, that resonate compassionately, that resonate joyously, and that resonate in equanimity while still remaining in relationship. Mm-hmm. On the most foundational level, we cannot lose this capacity. This is important to understand. There is an old term for these Brahmaviharas, which is called apamanya, which means immeasurable. Immeasurable, a quality of mind becomes when it is strengthened by deep stillness. I can experience friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity as a state. When this state becomes strengthened and fortified by profound stillness and clarity of mind, it becomes immeasurable. It expands beyond limits. That's why these states are also called immeasurables in the early teaching. The idea is that they radiate, that they are luminous. Radiate, the image of light, that's why the deity of Brahma is invoked here. It means, I dwell, I abide like a Brahma deity, which is in Buddhist cosmology, it's a deity consisting of light. So, light is not measured. You can measure its speed, but you don't measure its distance. So, if these Brahmaviharas have been purified and strengthened by deep stillness and by clarity of mind, then they become immeasureless, immeasurable. If you want to say something very simple, then you can say that these Brahmaviharas are the foundation of human growth. They're the foundation of human relationship. They're the foundation of friendship, of sangha. They're the foundation of civilization. Yeah? If you ever see a bunch of monitor lizards on the beach, and you look at them, and you realize this is not going to be the foundation of a civilization. Yeah. If you've ever seen monitor lizards, you know what I talk of. They're close. Or even a bunch of cows. I don't know how many of them are here. The last time I was here, there were 600 cows here. You look at 600 cows here over at the shed and you realize these animals, as nice as they are, as sympathetic as they are, and forgive a cheese-eating and milk-drinking Swiss to be very much in favor of those cows, I'm very clear that these cows are not the foundation of a civilization. They've been very, very useful in human experience. Many countries, but they're not going to be the foundation of a civilization. Something's not happening there that seems to be happening with human beings. And one of the things that seems to be happening with human beings is intelligence, inquisitiveness, coupled with empathy. And that mix together made it possible that we grow, not just individually, developmentally, but as a civilization. The Brahmaviharas are the root fabric that hold this together. You could also say They're very simple statements about human beings. The first one says, may all beings be well. The second statement would be something like, how miserable human beings are. The third one would say something like, let's rejoice with human beings. And the fourth one would say, human beings. Let us talk more tomorrow. For the time being, I know many of you have traveled. I sense a certain fatigue in the room, and I understand. Enough has been said from my part for tonight. Let's stretch our legs for a moment and do some walking meditation, and we'll meet at 9:15 back in here. Okay?